The number one resolution for people last year was to save more money, but nearly half gave up by February. Don't let that be you. Download Rocket Money to reach your financial goals this year. Track your spending, cut waste, and automate savings in one simple app. Rocket Money shows you all your expenses and categorizes them so you know exactly where your money's going and where you're overspending. From there, the app cuts waste by canceling your unused subscriptions and lowering your bills. No customer service needed. With that money freed up, the app will automatically set some cash aside for your goals, whether it's an emergency fund, paying off debt, or saving for vacation. Rocket Money's got you covered. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. And on average, users can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Make saving money a priority this year. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
People interested in true crime are always baffled by the why. Why would someone do these things? What path in life could possibly have led them to commit such atrocious acts? In this podcast, we aim to explore the upbringings and backgrounds of some of history's worst criminals, but with a twist. Because we want you to set aside what you already know about them, we won't use their names until the end of the show, so you can listen anew and hopefully get insight into the question that haunts us the most. Why did they do it? Join us as we explore The Catalyst. It was supposed to be a night like any other for Wendy Lynn Eistetter. As a sex worker in Vancouver's dangerous downtown East Side, she had seen her fair share of suspicious characters. The community she belonged to, of unhoused people, sex workers, and others who found themselves in this part of the largest city in British Columbia, tried to take care of each other. But nothing could have prepared Wendy for the man who pulled up on the night of March 22, 1998. Her desperation for money overrode any instinctual fear of the man in the red pickup truck. $100 would go a long way. But this driver wanted her to go back to his trailer in the country, which was always a dangerous option. Wendy realized her instincts were correct when she stepped into the filthy trailer parked back in the woods. A butcher knife lay in the middle of the kitchen table, one of the only clean things in the entire room. After earning her pay, Wendy asked to use the phone to report back to her pimp, but while she was looking up the number in a phone book, the butcher came up behind her and handcuffed one wrist. Without thinking, Wendy began fighting for her life. The fight moved throughout the small trailer, ending in the kitchen, where she grabbed the gleaming butcher knife. As she sliced his throat, she couldn't feel the multiple stab wounds to her own abdomen, pumping her blood all over the floor. As his blood swirled with hers on the dirty linoleum, Wendy escaped that trailer. She would be one of very few of the butcher's victims who would live to tell the tale. Leonard, the butcher's father, was born in England at the end of the 19th century, just 3 years before his parents immigrated to Canada. By the 1940s, he had gotten a reputation as lazy and unambitious by those around him. According to author Stevie Cameron's book, his family considered Leonard a confirmed bachelor, happy to work alone on his farm, but he surprised everyone by announcing his engagement to Helen Louise, a woman 16 years his junior who went by her middle name. After meeting in a coffee shop, he had proposed to Louise, a woman who would become the powerhouse of their family. But to anyone outside the house, Louise was considered a strange duck, only getting stranger as she aged. Neither took care of their teeth, losing most to rot. She lost the majority of her hair for an unknown reason and covered the small wisps of what remained with a kerchief. She also had a small beard that neighborhood children remembered years later. One of those now grown children also remembered her voice as a persistent high screech. Typically found in a cotton house dress over a pair of men's jeans, Louise matched her husband, who wore a dirty t-shirt, equally dirty jeans, and black rubber boots. The first of their children, Linda, was born in 1948, followed by the butcher, born on October 24, 1949. Their final child, David, was born a year later in 1950. Helen had a difficult birth with the butcher. He was born with the umbilical cord wrapped around his neck, something that made his family forever wonder if it had caused some kind of brain damage. They were correct. Nuchal cord, or being born with the umbilical cord wrapped around the neck, deprives the fetus of oxygen, which can then cause developmental delays, irritability, motor skill delays, and cognitive problems. According to the Office of Justice Programs, the cognitive model of crime and delinquency holds that criminal behavior is associated with cognitive defects. An article by R.R. Ross and E.A. Fabiano says that developmental delays, such as those that may arise from nuchal cord, prevent the acquisition of a number of cognitive skills that are essential to social adaptation. While it was likely that the butcher's cognitive issues had an impact on his later criminality, being born with the umbilical cord wrapped around his neck didn't affect his memory. Cameron writes that the butcher's earliest memories help illustrate the family's farm life and the poverty that plagued them. He remembered being about 2 years old and living in what sounded like a chicken coop. When he wanted water, he had to lift a floorboard under his bed to access a cold spring that ran under the house, coincidentally, the only running water in the house for years. By 3 years old, he was driving, even crashing his father's truck with pigs loaded in the back, into a tree. The butcher would later describe the incident to a prison pen pal, quote, "I turn around and the truck started rolling. The pigs all start jumping off and my dad's running behind the pigs trying to holler to stop the truck. I didn't know what to do, so I smashed it right into a telephone pole, totaled the truck right out. I sure got the hell beaten out of me, but that's what happens," end quote. The butcher's neighbors remembered the farm more for the smell than anything else. The odor of farm animals, chickens, ducks, dogs, the occasional cow or pig, animals the family allowed to roam through the house, leaving their waste behind them. Imagine growing up knowing nothing but a home barely discernible from a pig pen. And if that weren't enough, the butcher and his siblings were responsible for mucking out and cleaning the pig pens before and after school. And they didn't bother to bathe more than once a week, even though no amount of bathing would have ever been able to get rid of that stench. No wonder his classmates and neighbors' strongest memories were of the smells. Louise felt it was important for daughter Linda to feel included. She forced her eldest child to go to Sunday school, birthday parties, and even ride the bus with her classmates. Linda was given dresses to attend parties at her classmates' houses. Her mother seemingly understood that it was crucial for Linda to be socially accepted. However, Louise didn't feel the same about her sons. They only needed each other.
"I didn't realize I was wasting $415 a month until I downloaded Rocket Money. I thought I had my finances under control until the app laid out all my spending and categorized it for me. Takeout, shopping, and unused subscriptions were quietly draining my account. And as a result, my savings took a backseat. But Rocket Money doesn't just tell you what you're wasting money on. It takes action to save you money. First, the app looks at your income and monthly expenses and calculates how much you can safely spend each day to stay under budget. Rocket Money also finds and cancels unwanted subscriptions for you and even negotiates better rates on your bills, so you have more money in your pocket. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. It's time to simplify your finances and take control of your money. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Milo's Pro Rewards members, go big during Pro Savings Days at Lowe's. Buy more and save more with up to 20% off job site essentials like primed finger joint boards when you spend $3,000 or more. Plus, get up to 25% off PVC DWV pipes when you spend $250 or more. Shop Pro Savings Days at Lowe's. We help you save. Valid through 123. Selection varies by location. While supplies last. Loyalty program subject to terms and conditions. Visit Lowe's.com/terms for details. Subject to change.
Cameron calls Louise and Leonard appalling failures as parents, a fact that became even more apparent as the butcher began primary school. Beginning first grade in 1955 in a one-room schoolhouse, he was moved to a nearby school with better facilities, but his test scores were very low. His second grade teacher decided he would need to repeat the grade, and by the end of his second year in the second grade, he was an average performer. As he prepared for third grade, the school decided to put the butcher into special education classes, where he improved from outright failing to barely passing most of his courses. Even in elementary schools, his teachers began to nudge him toward occupational or trade classes to prepare him for jobs requiring little education or even training. Comparing the butcher to his classmates, both physically and mentally, presented several problems that warped his psyche. For one, his classmates didn't stink of pigs. In fact, many of them were the children of doctors. For years, the nearest neighbors to the butcher's farm was the New Essendale Hospital, a mental health facility built on 1,000 acres of cleared land. Construction on the hospital began in 1905, and by the mid-1950s, it was a sprawling hospital complex. The senior doctors lived in 5 huge houses on the hill, while the other homes were for the administrators and engineers who ensured the place ran smoothly. Each of the houses had large dining rooms, mahogany inlaid floors, landscaped gardens, and absolutely no manure inside. When those kids attended school, they wore nice clothes, carried homemade lunches, and waited for the bus at the same corner as the butcher. One doctor's daughter remembers taunting him. Quote, "We'd say to each other, just let us at him now and we'll make him talk. How are they different? Dirty and stinky. Man, they stunk. Their house was a poor house with no yard and falling down fences. There were no big trees, only some shrubs. I don't remember them at school at all, but I do remember them waiting for the school bus. Our bunch was mostly all doctor's kids. We were the best dressed and had the nicest houses. Almost everyone in the group is successful now." End quote. The butcher would eventually leave school at 15, with his sister saying he dropped out, while the butcher himself told a friend that he challenged the principal over a raunchy pen, one of those that reveals a naked woman when you turn it over, and the principal kicked him out. To the family, it didn't matter. Dropping out of school allowed the butcher more time for chores and even an apprenticeship. Louise arranged for her eldest son to apprentice for a local butcher, Bob Korich, who visited the farm to butcher their pigs. In 1963, the butcher's family moved to another part of Port Coquitlam, British Columbia. The town was growing so fast, their farm had been taken by eminent domain for a new highway and housing development. Louise and Leonard bought 40 acres on the eastern edge of town and paid for their ramshackle farmhouse to be lifted off its foundation and transported to their new property. The plan was to expand their pig and poultry business, raising and butchering the animals. In 1965, they purchased several large commercial freezers and registered a business called B&C Frosted Foods, listing Louise as proprietor. The farm was also listed as a business, B&C Frosted Food Bank, later changed to B&C Lockers, to better reflect what they did. Provide frozen lockers for hunters and farmers to store their meat until needed. Their new property quickly degenerated into another nasty pit. Keeping around 700 pigs and hundreds of chickens, with only one shower, there was no escaping their reputation as dirty, stinky people. By 1974, Leonard had descended into senility, Linda had left and was living in Vancouver, and the youngest sibling, David, had 2 children with his underage girlfriend, Sandy. The butcher had abandoned his apprenticeship after 6.5 years, partly because he was bored and partly because the family needed an income, so he started to drive trucks for BC Electric. Even with as many as 700 hogs on the farm at any one time, they still weren't making enough money to pull them out of poverty or allow them any rest from the 14-hour days of backbreaking work. According to Cameron's book on the butcher, while his brother was able to talk to women successfully, he had great difficulty speaking to the opposite sex. The loophole that he found in the mid-1970s? Pen pals. For those unfamiliar, there were many different ways you could find a pen pal, some of them domestic, but most were international, and they wrote letters back and forth as part of a cultural exchange. But for the butcher, finding pen pals, especially female ones, allowed him to finally hone what he would say to a woman and exactly how he would say it. In October 1974, soon after turning 24, he crossed the first of many lines by deciding to visit one of his favorite pen pals, a woman named Connie Anderson who lived over the border in Michigan. As it would be his first ever vacation, he celebrated by getting fall-down drunk before leaving and had to take a couple of weeks to recover. Finally departing in January, he took 6 weeks to get to Pontiac, Michigan, stopping along the way in Kansas City, St. Louis, and Chicago. He would tell another pen pal years later that Chicago terrified him, and he was constantly on the defensive because of all the black people he saw. Eventually making his way to Michigan, he met Connie, and by the time he left for home, he considered himself engaged to her. According to Cameron, he referred to Connie as the love of his life, but recognized any relationship between them was doomed because neither could leave their lives and move to be with the other. By April 1979, the butcher had suffered multiple losses. Both parents had died of cancer, and his brother's longtime girlfriend had finally left after David cheated on her one too many times. Unbothered by the mother of his two children leaving, David soon moved his new girlfriend, Vicki Evans, onto the family farm. Then the barns burned down, killing at least 600 pigs. When Vicki Evans moved in, she was often visited by her two younger sisters, Allison and Samantha. Allison, only six when she started visiting the farm, remembered many good times as a child. But according to Cameron, she also remembered a sludge pit used for dead piglets and pig waste and a psycho dog. She also recalled the butcher's dark, scary bedroom in the basement where he took her to teach her how to grind meat and make sausages. While David was finding success with the topsoil business, the butcher was still attempting to continue the family business of buying and butchering livestock. Drawing on his apprenticeship experience, he also worked with Patricio Casanova, a Filipino butcher who went by Pat. Casanova wanted to provide pork to the Filipino community and restaurants in Vancouver's Chinatown and knew of the butcher's pig business and meat lockers. Together, the two men began to buy pigs, which the butcher brought home to his farm to butcher, package, and store in his parents' freezers. His preferred method of killing the animal was to slit its throat with a knife, but if the animal was too large, he would shoot it in the head, typically with a nail gun. David continued a wannabe biker lifestyle, throwing random parties at the farm, parties that the butcher had no interest in attending. Part of David's party lifestyle included hanging out with Kathy Weyenberg and Karen Kaufman, both at his parties and on the farm during the day. David took Kathy and Karen into his brother's basement room one day before the butcher came home from work. According to Cameron's book, On the Farm, the door opened to reveal just a mattress on the floor with a gross black spot in the middle. On one wall was the taxidermied head of the butcher's childhood Palomino horse that he had to put down when it had injured its leg. On another wall was a family tree with local and family history pictures. And, of course, while David showed the women around, the butcher appeared in the doorway, incensed that there were people in his room. After spitting in Kathy's face, he hissed at David, "If she ever comes into this room again, I will kill her," he supposedly said. His relationship with Kathy never got better. Kathy and Karen remained friends with David and thus were in the butcher's life for quite some time afterward. Karen remembered that one year, around 1989 or 1990, she and her husband Jim joined David and Kathy on a weekend trip. Kathy brought along her live-in babysitter, described as a woman in her 40s with a grown daughter. But shortly after the weekend trip, the babysitter just disappeared. Concerned, Kathy reached out to the babysitter's daughter, but she hadn't heard from her mother and had no idea where she was. The police came around looking, but reached a dead end. And that wasn't the only time police had come around the butcher's farm. That's because by the late 80s and early 90s, there had been dozens of missing women reported. According to Michael Newton, writing for Crime Library, the neighborhood had taken an even darker turn. More psychiatric patients had been prematurely discharged, while the AIDS epidemic had taken its toll, with roughly one quarter of the neighborhood testing HIV positive. Dozens of women had disappeared. Rebecca Guno, 23, was last seen June 22, 1983. Sherry Rail, 43, was last seen in January 1984, but wasn't reported missing until 3 years later. Teresa Ann Williams, 26, was reported missing in March 1989, 9 months after she disappeared. The list went on and on and on. Another 18 women went missing before the Vancouver police detectives took an interest in the investigation. Meanwhile, the butcher began cruising the streets of Vancouver's downtown east side. According to Larry Campbell and Neil Boyd's book on the neighborhood, Downtown Eastside, also referred to as DTES, is one of the city's oldest neighborhoods, but it's plagued by disproportionately high levels of criminal activity. Not only did it draw more than its fair share of substance abusers and house people and sex workers, but it also drew former patients from psychiatric hospitals. They gravitated toward the neighborhood after being discharged by the provisional governments in the 1970s. The downtown east side was the only area they could afford and where they felt welcomed. Through the 1980s, authorities began to push what they considered to be the dangerous element, sex workers and drug dealers, out of the safer tourist areas and into the downtown east side as a way to concentrate them in one neighborhood, creating a sort of vice district. Mayor Campbell was unapologetic about this, even when questioned about the deaths of sex workers. He said it was unfortunate that they were being attacked and killed, but that citizen wanted them off the streets. It seemed to him that was more important. According to Cameron, despite the difficulties those who lived within the boundaries faced, they still had a strong sense of community. They looked out for each other. They tried to make it a neighborhood, sharing gossip, meals, and experiences. Sex workers added pictures of their children, pillows, and cozy blankets to their rented rooms. And how did the butcher find this neighborhood? Well, while taking unwanted animal parts to West Coast Reduction, a huge rendering plant only about a block away from the beginning of the neighborhood. Soon he became so well known at the rendering plant that he was just waved in by the friendly security guards without anyone even inspecting his containers of meat. He was such a good customer that if he couldn't get down to Vancouver, the butcher would arrange for someone to come to the farm and pick up the meat trimmings for him. Jim Kress was one such driver who picked up from the farm for roughly 4 years, from 1992 to 96, and said that in a typical week, he would pick up between 2 and 5 45-gallon drums, a minimum of 90 gallons of meat each week for 4 years. If Jim picked up every week, that's nearly 19,000 gallons of meat, but whether it was animal or human was a question Jim couldn't later answer. The lives of sex workers living in the downtown east side were made all the more dangerous as multiple serial killers were working in the area, including the butcher. In fact, so many victims had been found by the mid-1980s that the Royal Canadian Mounted Police finally established a task force in 1987. 12 officers were assigned to investigate 17 unsolved homicides going back to 1981, but they soon got stuck. While they had plenty of suspects, there was no real evidence to charge anyone. The task force disbanded in 1989 with no results, and the killings and disappearances continued. For years, it went unabated. Beginning in September 1998, some detectives sifted through dozens of case files to review 40 unsolved disappearances of local women going back as far as 1971. Their victim list would grow to include 54 women who had vanished between 1982 and 2001. The task force was able to eliminate 5 names because they were either found alive or their remains were found. These detectives wouldn't consider the butcher a suspect until a tip from Bill Hiscox, a 37-year-old widower with a substance abuse disorder. In 1998, Hiscox told the detectives about the two brothers and their farm, patrolled by a vicious 600-pound bear that would chase and bite after any intruder. He also alerted the police about the brothers' alleged charity called the Piggy Palace Good Time Society, registered in 1996 with the government to organize, coordinate, manage, and operate special events, functions, dances, shows, and exhibitions on behalf of service organizations, sports organizations, and other worthy groups. However, according to Hiscox, the so-called charity events were actually drunken parties featuring a slate of entertainment, including downtown Eastside sex workers. And at this point, Hiscox's tip landed differently because the year before, the butcher had been charged with the attempted murder of a sex worker, Wendy Lynn Eistetter, the woman mentioned at the top of this episode. A quick side note, every source has her listed as Wendy Lynn except Cameron's book, which calls her Sandra Gale Crawford. I can't find a reason for the discrepancy. Now, according to Cameron, the butcher picked up this woman just before 11 p.m. on March 22nd, stopping his red pickup truck in front of her. He offered her $100 to get back to his trailer. She was hesitant to travel that far away from the neighborhood, but she needed the money and climbed into the truck. When she followed the butcher into his trailer, she saw the large butcher knife lying on the table that sat in the middle of a filthy kitchen. The sex lasted about 5 minutes, and then she went to the restroom, after which she asked to use the phone to call her pimp to report in. It was while she was looking up his phone number in the phone book that the butcher handcuffed one wrist and she instinctually began to fight back. She punched him with her one free hand. If you'll remember, they fought through the house and into the kitchen until Wendy blindly grabbed behind her, closing her fingers around the butcher knife. Swinging wildly, she managed to slit the butcher's throat, cutting him deeply. As he started to bleed heavily, Wendy had the opportunity to escape, running toward the road, still waving the butcher knife. Luckily, she was able to flag down a passing motorist who used a phone to call 911. When she arrived at the hospital, doctors found she had 2 deep stab wounds in her abdomen and a punctured lung. But while she was in the operating room, another stabbing victim came into the same hospital, and if you guessed that that was the butcher, you're correct. He'd been cut from ear to ear and from ear to mouth, cutting off the tops of some teeth and part of his jawbone. With her testimony and defensive wounds, the butcher was charged with 1 count of attempted murder, aggravated assault, and unlawful confinement on April 8, 1997. But the butcher hired one of Vancouver's best defense attorneys and let it be known around the downtown east side that he was looking for Wendy. He wanted revenge if he could get it. And when the trial began on January 28, 1998, Wendy didn't appear. She was too afraid. Without a defendant and star witness, the judge dropped all charges. An article that appeared in the Vancouver Sun in 2010, with the benefit of over a decade's hindsight, journalists pointed out just how close the authorities had come to ending their collective nightmare back in 98. Instead, he was allowed to kill for years more. And when the butcher was being treated for his wounds, he was suspected of being the one who attacked Wendy, so police seized his jacket, sweatshirt, shirt, jeans, underwear, socks, and even his rubber boots. His clothes were put into an evidence locker and simply forgotten about until his eventual arrest years later. This attempted manslaughter charge was what convinced Bill Hiscox that the butcher was a serial killer, and it's what prompted him to go to the police. He alluded to the missing girls and, quote, all the purses and IDs that are out there in his trailer and stuff, end quote. Police recorded Hiscox's statement and even went with him to the pig farm, the first of three visits. Each time, police found nothing, but kept the butcher and his brother flagged as persons of interest, just not interesting enough to post surveillance on the farm. By the way, there were other persons of interest the Vancouver police looked into. Some of them will sound familiar to Catalyst listeners. Both Gary Ridgway and Keith Jesperson were considered and ruled out. The case again quieted for years, but then suddenly an arrest was made. Vancouver residents were blindsided, in a good way, when it was announced February 7, 2002. Finally, the butcher was in custody. Police had arrived at the pig farm the day before, on February 6th, to serve a warrant to look for illegal weapons. While executing the warrant, officers just so happened to stumble across the items Hiscox had mentioned, purses and IDs showing the names of women on their victim list. Police took the butcher into custody on the charge of possessing illegal firearms and resumed their search, this time with their eyes carefully looking for anything connected to the missing women.
The holidays are expensive. You're paying for gifts, travel, decorations, food, and before you know it, you've blown way past what you were planning to spend. Don't start the new year off with bad money vibes. Download Rocket Money to stay on top of your finances. The app pulls your income, expenses, and upcoming charges into one place so you can get the clearest picture of your money. It shows how much to set aside for bills and how much is safe to spend for the month, so you can spend with confidence. No guesswork needed. Get alerts before bills hit, track budgets, and see every subscription you're paying for. Rocket Money also finds extra ways to save you money by canceling subscriptions you're not using and negotiating lower bills for you. On average, Rocket Money users can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Start the year off right by taking control of your finances. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
At Pluralsight, we don't just teach skills. We are building the tech workforce who deliver results fast, accelerated by top-tier content. Lead with confidence. Lead with expertise. Visit us at pluralsight.com to tap in and learn more.
Quickly bailed out on the illegal weapons charge, the butcher had to be charged once again for first-degree murder. That came on February 22nd for the deaths of Serena Abbotsway and Mona Wilson. As the property search continued, detectives found an earring with Andrea Borhaven's DNA on it. They also discovered Kara Ellis's prayer card on a shelf in the butcher's slaughterhouse and her DNA on plastic sheets in his freezer. Additional charges were added throughout the summer, with a total of 15 murder charges by the end of September. 12 additional charges were added to the list on May 26, 2005, bringing the total against the butcher to 27. Remember the clothes that were taken from him at the hospital the night he attacked Wendy? According to the Vancouver Sun, after his arrest and in preparation for the trial, forensics labs tested the clothes and, 7 years later, they found DNA matching Andrea Borhaven on the butcher's rubber boots and DNA from Kara Ellis found on his nylon jacket. Both Andrea and Kara had disappeared from the downtown East Side in early 1997, just weeks before Wendy was attacked. As you've probably surmised, the butcher's MO was simple. While he took trips to the downtown East Side to drop off meat for rendering, he would swing by and kidnap and murder sex workers along the way. Charges were based upon evidence, small trophies found on the farm connecting the butcher to the victims. And a damning blow for both the case and the families, they weren't able to find any remains. Hearing that he allowed the remains to decompose naturally on the farm, fed the bodies directly to the pigs, or possibly ground his victims' bodies up and mixed the human remains in with the pork that he sold to the public. The butcher pleaded not guilty to the more than 24 charges of first-degree murder. Eventually, the judge would stay 20 of the counts, explaining that trying 26 charges all at once would put an undue burden on the jury and increase the odds of a mistrial. According to Canada's The Globe and Mail, the jury decided to find the butcher guilty of second-degree murder rather than first-degree, but that was enough to get him a life sentence with no possibility of parole for at least 25 years, the maximum sentence. When passing the sentence, Justice Williams said the butcher's, quote, conduct was murderous and repeatedly so. I cannot know the details, but I know this. What happened to the victims was senseless and despicable, end quote. So, who was this butcher, this terrible man who took the lives of Serena Abbotsway, 29, Mona Lee Wilson, 26, Andrea Josbury, 22, Brenda Ann Wolf, 32, Georgina Faith Papin, 34, Marnie Lee Ann Fry, 24, and likely upwards of 20 other women? It was Robert William Picton of Port Coquitlam, British Columbia. After he was convicted in 2007, Picton spent his sentence in maximum security. On May 19, 2024, he was brutally attacked by another prisoner while at the maximum security prison, the Port Cartier Institution. After the attack, Picton was airlifted to a hospital where he died. Family members of his victims were actually disappointed, not because they had any sympathy for the man who mercilessly killed their loved ones, but because they were still holding out hope that they might someday get answers to what happened. To research this episode, writer and historian Jen Erdman relied on Steve Cameron's book On the Farm, Robert William Picton and the Tragic Story of Vancouver's Missing Women, as well as several newspaper and other media sources, including the Vancouver Sun, the Globe and Mail, BBC, CBC, and the Crime Library. The Catalyst is a production of Grab Bag Collab, created and engineered by Amanda Rossman and narrated and edited by Amber Hunt. You can support us and our other programs at patreon.com/grabbagcollab. That's GRABBAGCOLLAB. Special thanks to Daisy Egan for being our first pass editor and a collaborator on Grab Bag. Music comes from Soundstripe Inc., my dad, Bruce Hunt, and my son, Hunt Van Benskoden.